We got an announcement to make here. We got something crazy going down. Check it out. We got free shots of vodka. That's coming through. Courtesy of Skid Row Radio.
Skid Row
Studios. That's right.
Skid Row Studios.
Skid Row Studios in the house. We're recording live tonight.
And we are broadcasting as well from King Eddie's.
Come get your shot of vodka.
Yeah. That's too easy.
Yeah, so hey, that was the old King Eddie's, a recording of the night that Skid Row Studios was at King Eddie's Saloon in downtown Los Angeles before it shut down and changed hands. And that was a crazy night. Everybody was there. I don't know how we even afforded to buy all those shots that we supposedly bought, but they pulled it off, and people are getting tours of the underground tunnels, and there was fights and all kinds of reporters there trying to capture the magic of the last night of the old King Eddie's. I still go into King Eddie's. It's now reopened, different owners, somewhat of a different vibe. And when I'm on a bit of a bender right now. I've been drunk for like 4 days. Trying to kill the pain, trying to take away the pain. And while I was in there, someone stopped me when I was walking to the bathroom, and she said, "Hey, aren't you from Skid Row Studios?" And her name is Hazel, and she's here with me. Hazel, what's up?
Hey, how's it going? Yes, I did stop you. I do remember meeting you that night. It was like maybe one of the last 3 nights before the King Eddie closed.
Yeah, it wasn't the last night. I think we wanted to broadcast on the weekend, and I think the very last night was either Sunday or a Monday.
Yeah, it was Sunday going into Monday morning. I was actually there.
Yeah.
It was a hot mess. People were fighting that night. It was crazy. You're right. I mean, like at some point, I think the bartenders just kind of gave up like charging people, and people were just like buying drinks and not really paying for them, and it was a free-for-all. You know, I take seriously the fact that they said, you know, help drink the King Eddie dry. I took that very serious. So I was there all weekend long, and I wanted to make sure that I at least drank them dry of, like, Jaeger, because that's my drink of choice.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I helped. I did my part.
And you polished off every bottle of Jaeger that was
in. You know what? Yeah, I actually think I did. I mean, at some point on Monday morning, it was probably, like, 1:30, right before the supposed last call, which was at 2. It wasn't the actual last call because they actually closed the bar closer to like 5 a.m. They couldn't find any more bottles of Jaeger. So I just kind of started drinking beer, but it was good. It was fun. It was just kind of sad. You know, you're saying goodbye to your friends and the bar family, and you don't know when you're going to see them again.
Yeah. I mean, I was really concerned when I found out that King Eddie's was closing, and for me, I had gone through this with a few other bars in downtown Los Angeles, probably the most famous being Krabby Joe's, where really when that bar closed, you know, I kind of lost a piece of my soul. I had such great times in that bar. I became good friends with the owners. There's so much history in that bar. I met a girlfriend that I was with for four
That's
years
so cute.
After that bar. Yeah, and so I just had a lot invested emotionally in that bar, and I kind of saw the same thing happen. Unfortunately for Krabby Joe's, it never reopened, and that was it. And now I actually see people doing things with it when I drive by over on 7th and Main. So it may come back to life, but a bar like that and like King Eddie's, it's not a bar that happens overnight. It takes a lot of time to make a great bar like that.
No, it totally does. And I can totally agree with you. Like, I came to King Eddie's. I mean, I've been working in Skid Row for a few years, and I would always like drive past King Eddie's, and it kind of looked shady from the outside, and I contemplated like whether I really wanted to go there or not. And so one day I found out that Bukowski was known to be a drunk there, and he's my favorite author. So I was like, you know what, I'm just going to go. And I went, and as soon as I set foot, it was like a Thursday, I just fell in love with everybody that was in there and the place in general. So I was a regular fixture every Thursday and Friday. And it was really sad because they told us actually that the bar was going to close like during the summer, and it was like July, and they were like, yeah, it's going to close in August. And August came and went, they're like, no, it's closing September. And every month it felt like we were
pushed.
Yeah, like it kept getting pushed. And then finally December came around, and they're like, December 17th, that's the last day. And I almost didn't want to believe it at first, because I just thought, you know, it just feels like we're part of a bar family. Why would you close it before like the holidays, you know? But no, they closed it, and it was all over. It was very emotional.
And who are some of the people that you remember from the bar?
Well, there's my Bob, who still drinks there, and he still sits at the same bar stool that he used to sit at before it changed ownership. There's Frankie, who doesn't really come in there that often anymore. I hear he likes to hang out like at the Five Star, even go as far as like the Frolic Room. There's Kenneth and Kathy, who kind of hang out like in the down and out. And there's Pancake, who's my favorite. And I mean, last Friday was the first time I had seen him all year. And I think he comes in there every once in a great while. But before, he was there like every Thursday and Friday, sometimes even Saturdays. So
it was funny when we saw Pancake this last time, because we... It was one of those strange, like, is his ears burning kind of thing? Because
no, he's Beetlejuice. I told you, if you say his name three times, he will appear. I said Pancake like three different times in our conversation, and then there he was. It's like he knew. He knew.
Yeah, he walked right through the door right when we were saying his name.
Yeah, no, I love Pancake. I mean, he called me probably like in April. I'm not really sure how he got my number, but he called me and he was all happy and he was like, Happy New Year. And I'm like, Pancake, it's April. But he's so excited, you know, and he adopted me as his niece. And I don't know, he's just amazing. And he's like one of those characters where it's like, it's so very obvious that at any other bar, he probably wouldn't really fit in. But at the King Eddie, it was just like so perfect. Him and a bunch of other characters that are like that. I don't know if you know Blade. Have you seen Blade?
No.
Well, another character that would not fit in anywhere else. Like, he has, like, these plastic toy guns that he's, like, spray painted black. And he wears, like, kind of, you know, like the movie Blade? He kind of looks like that, you know? And he walks in there and that's just how he is, you know? I mean, there's something to be said about that.
Yeah, these characters that we see in these types of bars and you don't really care about where they came from or where they're going as much as you do, like, watching how they interact with the bar and the friends that they've made within those bars. And so when King Eddie's was closing, I was really scared for a lot of those people. And even myself, you know, where am I going to go after this? Because I'm the kind of person that I like the bars that are somewhat empty and dark, and you know, people don't ask too many questions except for, you know, when you're asking. And I don't know, it's like something that would be missing from that area. But really, I wanted this discussion to be a much more bigger discussion about downtown and gentrification and what's happening to Skid Row. And tell us a little bit about yourself, Hazel. You work in the Skid Row area.
Yeah, I do. I've been working in the Skid Row area probably for like the last 5 years. And that's kind of around the same amount of time that, you know, we've seen like the biggest changes happening in downtown LA. And I mean, I think the King Eddie changing ownership was kind of like testament to that, because I mean, there's no other bar really in downtown. They're all kind of catering to like this certain crowd, this young kind of hipsterish crowd, and where these people, like, they wouldn't really fit in. And the reason why King Eddie was so special and unique, part of it was the people that go there. And the fact of the matter is that the drink prices at one time were pretty cheap. So people that were living on fixed income, that are living like in the SROs and subsidized housing that's around downtown LA. I mean, they could afford to go to these places and still feel like they were part of a community in a sense. And now it's kind of like they're getting pushed out, you know? So it's changing.
I feel like there is somewhat of a systematic elimination of Skid Row, and you see these things here and there. And I mean, at one point, the Skid Row Housing Authority was able to stop a lot of new bars from opening up in that area because of the number of people who are trying to fight addiction. But then it almost feels like if you have a certain amount of money and a certain amount of history in downtown, which that group does, then you're able to get away with a lot. And I almost feel like behind closed doors, even if it's not said, it goes without saying that they purchasing that whole block is going to change the map of Skid Row once again. And it's pushing further east, and it's being more concentrated. And, you know, if it keeps going the way that it's going, I don't really see there being a Skid Row 5-6 years down the road.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting that you would say that, because so I used to, at one point or another, I used to work at this law office. And so I was really good friends with, like, this attorney who, I mean, he had great musical taste. So that's kind of like how we hit it off. But when I was still kind of new to the area and still kind of learning as to what was going on and, like, this whole idea with gentrification, like, he once told me, you know, to really think of gentrification in downtown as kind of like this giant. And to imagine, like, this giant was walking around and just kind of, like, taking buildings and establishments and businesses for itself. And then to imagine this giant going into Skid Row with, like, a leaf blower and, like, turning it on and kind of pushing, like, all these homeless people into neighboring communities. And so he said, imagine if you physically could not see homeless people in Skid Row because they kind of got pushed into, like, the neighborhood communities. So if you don't see homelessness, you know, what's the purpose of the nonprofits that are down here? And he kind of told me, you know, like, nonprofits, like anything else, it's a business. So if there is no demand for these services, like any other business, they'll close. And so if they close, like, what does that mean for Skid Row? You know, will it cease to exist? And that doesn't mean that chronic homelessness or any type of homelessness is over. It just means that now it's just not visible.
Right. Yeah. But visibility is a huge thing for the new types of people that are moving into this area. If it's not seen, then it's not a problem. And I feel like that, you know, they know that here in this city. And they know, in order to attract more and more people who have money into the area, all they have to do is sweep this homeless thing under the rug, and it's gonna make those people think that it doesn't exist.
Exactly. And I think we see that especially, like, when, you know, on Thursdays when there's the art walk, just because,
yes.
I don't go to the art walk, but I did, out of curiosity, go to one art walk 1 month. And, you know, you see all these crowds of people, and they're going from establishment to establishment, and some, like, are drunk or very visibly drunk on the street, and they don't get ticketed and nothing happens to them. And then there happens to be a homeless person on the corner, like, panhandling, and now all of a sudden that's an issue. And any other day of the week, that same person could still be there panhandling, but it's okay. It's just that, you know, they're visible,
right,
to, like, huge crowds now. So now it's an issue, you know?
Art walks stopped being about art a long time ago, and now it's just about, like, hipsters from other towns coming in and drinking at the bars. And I mean, I see people smashing bottles and laughing about it, and just an overall disrespect for downtown and the people who have lived here for some time and have made the decision to make downtown their home. I just hate seeing Art Walk. I stay in on that night. I avoid it at all costs. And I don't see anybody, I mean, buying art at Art Walk. It's just a hipster fest, and that's really unfortunate, because I remember when Art Walk was about art, and it was, you know, one block over on 4th and Main in the old bank district was the Art Walk, and there was art, and people would let people into their living spaces, but now, yeah, it's just all controlled by galleries and food trucks.
Exactly. Oh my God, the food trucks. There's like a billion food trucks everywhere.
Yeah.
And they have like all these different kinds of food. Oh my God, it's terrible. I don't know. I don't appreciate it. I mean, I know people that go to it, you know, kind of religiously, and they like it. They enjoy themselves, and that's great, but it's not really my thing.
So what about the social services? I think one of the misconceptions that people have when they come to downtown and they do see someone homeless on the street, panhandling, whatever, I think one of the misconceptions is that's what Skid Row is. And I don't think people realize that Skid Row has a lot of social services. They're doing a lot to try to help those people, but those people have to make the choice to take advantage of those services. And some people just don't. Some people want to be insane. They want to be high all day, and that's the mode that they're in. But I don't know. I feel like people think that Skid Row is just this place where homeless people gather, and it's just this concentration of drugs and everything, which it is, but the social services are there, and nobody thinks about that. So my fear is that when Skid Row gets eliminated, those social services are also going to go away. And when those go away, then, you know, nobody's getting helped at all.
Well, I think, first of all, I think there's a lot of stigma, you know, surrounding what Skid Row is, and also, like, this idea of homelessness, because I know there's a lot of people that think, like, well, people choose to be homeless, or it's because, you know, they're addicted to drugs and they would rather just spend all their money on drugs and not have a home or have a job and stuff like that. And that's definitely not true. Being that I've been working here for a number of years, I mean, I've met people that have been homeless for like 10 years or longer. The reason that they became homeless was nothing related to drugs. It was mostly because they had a mental illness that had gone untreated. They weren't even aware that they had this mental illness. I mean, think about people that have degrees from like Harvard that, you know, have had this like luxurious lives. And then all of a sudden it just took a turn for the worse, and they didn't have a support system in place that to really help them kind of guide them out of this like tough spot. And they just somehow ended up here. I think a lot of homeless people come to Skid Row from other states because they don't have the same amount of social services that we have available here. And in addition, I mean, California has beautiful weather on a regular basis. I mean, there's people that became homeless in New York that come here because, you know, the seasons over there. I mean, there's rain, there's snow. People don't survive on the streets. And so a lot of it, I think, has to do with like self-preservation. Even this whole concept of like homeless people and drug use. I mean, some people didn't use drugs until they got to Skid Row, and it was mostly to help them cope with like their mental illness or with their situation. And I think any one of us in that situation might have resorted to the same thing, you know? So I think it's definitely like a stigma. In terms of social services, I do see like a change happening in Skid Row. So I think before we were very comfortable working in silos, meaning that every organization was really good at working with a certain population and doing certain types of services, and we didn't really communicate with one another. We didn't really collaborate. And now I'm starting to see a shift. I'm noticing that more and more people want to collaborate because we finally are realizing that when we work together, we can accomplish so much more. So as a community, we're growing, and I think that we're serving a lot more people that are harder to serve, that we're finding that there's been people that have been homeless in downtown and in Skid Row for over 30 years, and, you know, it's time that we start prioritizing our resources to them. So it's changed.
Do you see things going in favor of the social services, or is it harder and harder each year to keep what's available in place?
It is becoming harder, but I do think that the shift now...
Why do you think it's becoming harder?
I think, well, part of it is this whole idea of collaboration. Other major cities... So I don't remember where I read this or where I heard this, but someone said that LA was actually the capital of homelessness for the US. And so that's kind of like a title that we've had for a very long time. And part of it is because we haven't really followed the models that other major cities such as like Chicago or New York have had, where they collaborate. There's funding that's kind of incentivized to helping communities continue collaboration, foster that idea, and to really help the hardest to serve people in their community, their homeless neighbors. And so in LA, we haven't really had that. I really strongly believe that this year that's changed, and that at least at the ground level, so like people that provide direct services, like outreach workers and case managers, they've always believed and they've always known that we had the tools to collaborate, that we had the tools to move this community forward. But it's always kind of been like the higher ups that haven't really been on board with that. And I feel like that's changing. And part of that change has meant that we are collaborating, and that now we're not so... I guess we're not trying to grasp for credit. Like, that's not the priority. The priority is just housing our homeless neighbors.
Have you felt any change come down yet from the new mayor?
A little bit. I mean, there's definitely, like, we're trying to get information out as to what we've been doing. There's, like, this new initiative going on in Skid Row called Coordinated Entry System, and it's kind of like a model that came to us from Chicago because it was very successful there in terms of like the nonprofits coming together and helping, you know, the chronically homeless and the most vulnerable. And so we're doing that in Skid Row. And it's crazy because Skid Row embarked on like this 100-day initiative, and it proved to be so much more successful than what anyone thought it was going to be. And so now that that's over and we're talking about how we're going to sustain the system, there's a lot more other communities in LA County that want to know what we've done and kind of want to mimic that same model in their own communities, and kind of just like piecing this together as a county, you know? And that's something that hasn't really happened prior to this.
I remember working in New York City, I think it was around 97, 98. I grew up in a real small town in northeast PA. We didn't really have homeless issues. It wasn't something I was exposed to until I went to the big city. And I remember in New York City, it was almost like it was overnight, where one day, there's a definite homeless problem. I remember the first time I saw someone that really like shook me, because it's obvious this person is at the low end of their life. It was just a woman who had nothing on but a trash bag. She's just laying there asking for change, and that was my first exposure to someone who's really down and out, and what that means or what that kind of looks like. Coming from a white suburban town, you don't understand those things. It's not something that you grow up with. It's not in your environment. But then I remember just a shift in New York City that just seemed to happen very quickly, where homeless people, there was people dedicated to helping homeless people get into shelters and safer places. And they would literally take them, and help them get to these places, because a lot of times they couldn't get there themselves. I'm surprised sometimes that I'll see people like that here in downtown LA, and not so much in Skid Row, but outside of Skid Row, where I'll see a guy laying on the street, and I don't know if he's even dead or not. Like, the guy's just out, and everybody's just walking over them. Everybody just goes by. I see the guys on bicycles, just kind of whatever. And where I feel like they at least did something about that in New York City to help those people that obviously like were really on the outs. And I don't know. LA never seemed to approach things in that way.
Yeah, I think that's changing this year, though. So we did like the homeless count in January, and we kind of came up with like this prioritization equation to kind of help us navigate from all the homeless people that are like within the downtown and Skid Row area, you know, who we should prioritize towards getting housed first. Ideally we want to house everyone, but unfortunately right now, I mean, our resources are so limited and so scarce. So we definitely have taken a more like purposeful approach towards helping our chronically homeless neighbors by prioritizing those that we feel that due to medical conditions or how long they've been homeless, if we don't house them first, they may be people that will be dying on the sidewalks. So we've taken a more purposeful approach, but I think the bigger issue is that, you know, we can provide all these different services and get people back on their feet and stuff. But at the end of the day, if we're not helping them navigate towards housing because housing is still so limited and still so scarce in LA County, I mean, how much more can we do? You know, I think that's the bigger issue.
Does a civil rights issue come up at all in the sense that what if this person that you want to help, that you know is next to death's door, what if they just don't want to do it? I mean, is there a certain point where you have to kind of let this person die on the street?
Well, I mean, we do run into people that, you know, for example, we've worked with people that have been homeless for like 20, 30 years. And, you know, in the past, they've either attempted to get services or someone has offered them services and they've kind of fallen through the cracks. And because of that experience, they feel very discouraged. I mean, I think that's like a natural reaction, and therefore they distrust people in general. I mean, that does happen. We do see that a lot, especially with those people that have been homeless the longest. But I mean, we definitely want to continue working with them. It's not something where we kind of forget about them or sweep it under the rug. We want to continue building that rapport and make sure that when they are ready to, you know, move forward, that we're there to push them and keep going. Sometimes what I've seen, like with outreach or case management services, I mean, sometimes that can mean working with someone, you know, 3 to 6 months. At times that's meant working with someone for a year. And you know what? That's what it takes.
Yeah. I just wonder, though, if, I don't know, some people out there, this is the life that they've chosen, and they have this in their mind that they can't do any better and surrender to that. And I don't know. I'm just curious about those types of cases where people just really have given up all hope.
Yeah, no, we see that all the time. But I mean, we work through it. We work through it, and we'll work through it for as long as it takes. I think sometimes like not being motivated or being discouraged, like those qualities have kind of been used to villainize our homeless neighbors in a sense, to kind of shrug our shoulders and be like, well, you know, we tried and they didn't really want this bad enough or something like that. But I mean, sometimes you just really have to put yourself in their shoes. I mean, if you've been out in the streets, you know, in self-preservation mode for a decade or longer, I mean, wouldn't you naturally distrust people in general? I mean, if someone was offering you like something really amazing, would you not believe it? I mean, you don't want to get your hopes up. You know, it's such a natural thing.
Yeah. Well, hey, we're going to take a little bit of a break. I think when we come back, let's lighten it up a little bit and talk about, you know, our experiences in the bars and maybe funny stories. And yeah, let's do that. But we'll be right back.
SKIDROW, from the wall to the door. What you want to do? Do you want some hardcore? Do you like it raw? South Olive, downtown LA, Skid Row Studios, motherfucker.
Hi, this is Vic Cohen. What are you doing Wednesday nights at 10 o'clock Pacific time? It's a fair question. Well, whatever you're doing, even if it's making love, I'd like to join you. May I? Hey, it's a fair question. Just go to SkidRowStudios.com Wednesday nights at 10 p.m. Pacific time for Vic Cohen's It's a Fair Question. I promise I'll be gentle.
All right, so the first half hour, we kind of got pretty deep into Skid Row and what's going on in that area, and Hazel has a unique perspective on it since she works in that area and deals with these issues and really knows what's going on. The second half hour here, I just want to get into fun bar stories. You know, there's been so many really just fun, crazy stories that came out of both King Eddie's and for me, Krabby Joe's. So let's start off with that. What do you got? What was funny? Something that happened over there at King Eddie's.
My gosh, I don't want to say her name, but there used to be this female bartender that was over there, and there was only two. So I guess you
can cross. You can narrow it down.
Yeah, you can narrow it down. But one, I don't think I ever really saw her drink. And towards the end, she started drinking and she was very sassy and, you know, very girly and just very touchy-feely. And towards the end, like, she was hitting on one of the other bartenders who, like, was not really interested in her but just being really polite. And anyway, she flashed him. And in flashing him, she flashed everyone else that was at the bar.
She kind of forgot she was in a bar? Or?
Yeah. Well, not only that, but, you know, like, the bar is kind of like a square. So when you're in the center of it, I mean, you really are in the center of it. Like, anyone can see you. And so she was in the center of it, and she just, like, flashed him and flashed everyone. I was just, like, I was afraid to grow up. I was afraid to get old. I saw her boobs. I was just like, oh, I don't want to get like that.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I remember a night in Krabby Joe's. I don't know if it was a full moon or what, but there was just all kinds of things happening in that bar. And this guy came up to the bar. He had a guitar with maybe like two strings on it. And he was using a crushed up Coors Light can as like a slide on the guitar. And the funniest thing about this guy, he came up to us and he's just like playing like he's playing in front of a stadium, and he's just playing his heart out. Meanwhile, it sounds like cats crying, you know. It was just like didn't make any noise, any music at all, but he's playing it hard. And the funny thing about this guy is that he had no sleeves on, and what I mean by that is he had a shirt where he had the cuffs of his hands, but then from there it was like the sleeves were ripped off. And it was just, we called him Sleevey McGee, and he, you know, he could play a tune for you, and he would make up lyrics like right on the spot. And yeah, that guy was insane, but he was having a great time as far as he was concerned.
Oh my God, I love that. I'm so sad. I was one of those people that I never got to see Krabby Joe's, but I hear about it even now, and I just wish I could have gone at least once. I mean, I hear that the Krabby Joe sign is in some like art store or something.
Yeah, so I bought the sign, and I had it restored by the Museum of Neon Art. They put me in touch with someone, and for a long time, it was kind of going from one place to another, and one place kind of took it and put it in their art display and kind of took it apart and made this really strange, abstract view of it, which I was just uncomfortable with people doing different things with the sign. So the people over at Raw Materials Art Store said, hey, we'll put it here. Nobody will mess with it until something comes along. And it's been there ever since. And yeah, you can go in there, you can check it out. They'll turn it on for you. I had it because even myself, I never had the opportunity to see it with functioning neon when it was still on the bar. and I gave this cool Japanese guy that was doing the restoration for me, I gave him a video clip of Barfly, the beginning of Barfly, and I just said, just make it look exactly like that again. And that's what he did. So if you go over to Raw Materials, you can check it out and tell him to turn it on, and it'll flash like it did in the movie Barfly.
Oh, my God, that's amazing. I need to go over there and see it. I saw a picture of it online. I'm friends with a couple of people who were once part of the, like, clientele for the King Eddie's before it closed. And so someone posted a picture of it online and was like, do you know where this is? And a lot of people responded like, yeah, it's at this art store. And that warms my heart.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that I always wanted to see the neon function. And there's all kinds of interesting little stories around that sign. You know, for a long time, the neon artists were confused as to how the neon was specifically configured to make it look like it did in Barfly. And they kept trying to tell me that it was... they used camera tricks, and I knew there was no way that Barfly was going to pay for special effects. So what was filmed in that movie is what happened, because they didn't have the budget. They barely got that movie made. So there's no way they're paying for special effects, and I just never bought that story. And it wasn't until I went to one of the brewery open houses, where over at the brewery district, where the art colony over at the brewery over in Lincoln Heights, they had an open house, and I walked through there, and this guy had these full-scale, high-resolution photos of the Krabby Joe's sign with the old neon in place. And from these pictures that I just happened to run into, this guy didn't know who I was, I didn't know who he was, I'm just walking through his space, and I'm like, hey, like, I need those right now. And and he sent me the original photos, and I shipped this off to the neon artist, and they're like, oh, yeah, it makes perfect sense now. Like, we couldn't have done it without these pictures. So, yeah, just the randomness of what brought that together was pretty special. And when it was restored, we kind of did a little unveiling at the Raw Materials art store. If you go on YouTube and search for Krabby Joe's, Krabby with one B, you'll find this little video where they do a historical reflection on the address of Krabby Joe's and what it was in many different past lives. And, you know, some man killed his wife because she didn't agree with taking his shoes off or something, you know, back in 18-something-something, you know. Like, crazy stuff like that all happened at that address.
That's crazy. I love that story. And you know what? That's what I miss about the King Eddie, like the neon light signs. I mean, I hear that part of the reason why they don't have anything neon in the bar is because it would cheapen it. But, I mean, I think that was part of its charm, you know. I miss that.
You can cheapen something, but its cheapness was authentic.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, yes, gaudy neon signs all over the place make it look cheap, but those neon signs have collected on those walls for longer than most of the people going there have lived. And so, yeah, I don't know. That's a strange one. They should have just left it alone, personally. But, you know, and the other thing, I don't want to veer off into too much negativity, but, you know, there was a particular bartender that used to yell at the regulars that went back to King Eddie's even after the reopen, and there was this one guy that would just bitch about them not tipping him enough and stuff like that. And I don't know, that kind of made me a little upset. Those guys have been going there their whole lives. Why would you want to, you know, maybe they don't tip much because they're on fixed incomes, but they're going to be there on that bar stool every single day. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I totally know who you're talking about. And know what? So that same conversation came up with me, and I sassed him a little bit because, yeah, you know, you need to put perspective into this. Like, sure, it is a new bar, and yes, it's new ownership, and you're trying to get, like, a different crowd in there and whatever, but you have to respect the fact that for years, and we're talking about, like, 30 years and more, Like, this bar belonged to the community, and the community is not who you're trying to cater to, you know? So I think they need to get a little bit of perspective. But I mean, no, not to be negative, but the new King Eddie is nice. You know, it's clean. The staff, you know, is pretty nice. And some of the regulars can still be found there. It's just a little sad. It's just a little disheartening because, I mean, I remember going in there like on a Thursday or Friday, and the music would be like blasting from the jukebox, and there'd be people like already drunk off their asses, and like there'd be so much laughter and so much joy. And now it's a little bit harder to find, I feel. Like it just feels so much more lonely in there.
Yeah.
And I don't remember it being like that at all.
Yeah.
At all. But my Bob still goes there, and I plan to celebrate his birthday big. So my Bob has been going to this bar for like 30 years. And he lives in downtown, and he, last year we celebrated his birthday, and I have to say, in my entire life, I've never, ever, ever been stood up by a man, and Bob stood me up for his birthday, because I brought cupcakes, and we were going to celebrate his birthday, and he did not show, and I was very, sad about that, but this year, he's going to be there, so...
Why didn't he show?
Well, okay, so he was really excited. He knew that I was coming, that we were going to, like, you know, bring party hats, and I was going to light candles, and we were going to sing to him and everything. He knew this. And so he got to the bar early that day. It was, like, a Thursday. And by 3 o'clock, he was drunk. And he was like, I'm going to go take a nap, and then I'm going to come back by 5:30 because he knew I was going to be there. He went to go take a nap, and he turned in for the night. And it was all over.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he knows we're going to be there again, and I'm going to be there with my cupcakes. We're going to celebrate. I think he's turning like 76.
Wow.
Yeah, and he actually, it's really interesting because he actually used to be a bar owner. I don't remember the bar that he owned, but he owned a bar like many years ago in downtown. And what happened was kind of similar to like the King Eddie in the sense that the bar was in some building and the building got bought out by some company and they basically didn't want to have the bottom floor be the bar anymore. So he got kind of like, bought out in a sense and was forced to close.
Bob sounds like he'd be a great guest here at the studio. I mean,
he would. I mean, he sounds kind of like Marlon Brando in The Godfather. He has like this like oh, you know, like you can barely hear him kind of voice.
That's okay. We'll
yeah,
turn the mics
no,
up.
He's amazing.
I bet he's got great stories.
He has many great stories. Like, okay, so for example, this weekend he went to San Francisco because. In the last 15 years, he only gets his hair cut in one place. And this one place is in, like, Chinatown, San Francisco. So every 3 months, he goes over there and he gets his hair cut from the same, like, Vietnamese woman that has been cutting his hair for, like, the last 15 years. And he went there just randomly, like, 15 years ago. And he went in there and she, like, hacked up his hair. Like, it was terrible. Like, she just, I guess she was, like, drunk, and she just kind of went for it and just messed up his hair. And before he could say anything, he will tell you, like, in a heavy accent, she was like, well, don't worry, babe. It'll grow back. And after she said that to him, he told me, he's like, I fell in love. So he literally goes there every 3 months to see her specifically. Like, I don't even think this woman cuts hair anymore. I think she knows that he's coming, and she'll cut his hair. You know? It's crazy.
Beautiful.
Yeah. But he does that every 3 months. So this weekend he's in San Francisco getting his hair cut.
I have one King Eddie story. There was a time that myself and a bunch of my friends were drinking at the bar, and we were on the west side of the bar, I guess you could say, facing the door. And it was my friend Aaron, who was the son of Ike and Jenny, who owned Krabby Joe's, and a few of our other friends. I forget who, but Aaron was there for sure. Some guy comes running into the bar, and he's kind of huffing and puffing like he's been running. And he comes into the bar. He's got no shoes on. He's got no shirt on. And his chest is covered in blood. And the bartender looks at him and just says, I can't serve you. And the guy looks at him and he goes, why? Because I ain't got no shoes on? And I just thought that this was fucking hilarious. The shoes, okay, maybe you should have some shoes on, but it was probably the blood all over your chest that might have did it. That might have pushed it over.
Yeah, no, I love that. There was this one guy, too, who, like, had no control over his bladder. So the bartenders knew that after, like, his sixth drink, they needed to slow it down with him or not. He was going to, like, pee on the bar stool. Like, simultaneously, like, going to sleep, but also be peeing, you know? And the thing is, like, he had done this so many times, and they totally didn't judge him, that they just knew, you know? So after, like, whatever drink he was drinking, after, like, it got to, like, number six, they knew, like, you need to slow down, you know? Because they knew he was going to pee, so, but
that's
they wouldn't
kick him out.
That's
funny, because they're cutting him off not because he's drunk, but because he's going to piss himself.
Exactly.
That's great.
You know, that's awesome. Or also, I don't know, did you ever meet, I don't think I remember his real name, but we used to call him the Night Stalker. Did you ever meet
no.
him? So we called him the Night Stalker because physically, he actually sort of looked like Richard Ramirez, but he would actually dumpster dive, like, so around 6 o'clock, you know, all the flower shops that are kind of like outside of downtown would start to close. So he'd go dumpster diving and he'd pick out like these bouquet of flowers that they would throw out. And so he'd come to the King Eddie and he'd try to sell them, or he'd try to trade like flowers for a drink, you know. And so everyone just knew him and no one would judge. He would just come in, get a drink and be on his way. You know, I would buy bouquets of flowers from him just because they were still fresh, they were still pretty, they smelled great, and it was just cute. And so sometimes, like, I would be leaving the King Eddie, you know, all drunk with my like 3 or 4 bouquets of roses, and people would be like, there goes like the king's queen, like there goes like the prom queen. And it was cute.
One thing I used to love to do at King Eddie's, I don't know if I've done it since or if it's even still there, it was ring the bell. And if I could afford it, and if there wasn't too many people in the bar, I'd buy a round for the entire bar and they'd ring the bell. And the thing that I loved is just everybody's face lighting up, like whatever is going on that day, we just got a free drink, fuck it. Everything's fine, you know? And I always loved that because you'd feel that love coming from everybody in the bar.
Oh, yeah, there was lots of love in that bar. Like, you know, their slogan was like, where no one gives a fuck what your name is, but people knew your name. If not your name, they knew your face. There was lots of love in that bar.
Yeah.
And the brass bell, yes, I do remember the brass bell. In fact,
is it still there? I forget.
No. Well, those last 3 days, you know how they were selling everything off?
Yeah.
That was the one and only item that I wanted. And
oh, wow.
I don't know if you remember. I'm pretty sure you were there because you guys did the podcast. But on that Friday, they started to like bid off the neon signs. And probably not even like 45 minutes into bidding stuff off, like the owner was just kind of over it. And he stopped it. And he pretty much was like, come back on Sunday and point out what you want and then just put a price on it and just take it. Well, I had my eye on the brass bell the entire time, but when I came back on Sunday, like so many things were gone, and yeah. That was one of them. Yeah.
Yeah, he went through and took some of the things that he specifically wanted, because there was a few things in there that I could tell just kind of disappeared. Some of the better items.
Yeah, there were some items in the basement too. Like, I feel so fortunate because I got the opportunity to go into the basement and take pictures of like the murals, and there was just like these boxes full of like, I guess they were wine glasses, but just like things that, you know, had been hanging around for years and years, and like these broken chandeliers and these old school looking cash registers. So I got to like go in there and take pictures of it. I mean, I don't know what it looks like now, but I think they've cleared most of it off because I think they're trying to like renovate that space.
They're trying to make a speakeasy style thing, something.
Yeah. I mean, I just hope that the murals are still intact. I think they are. But, I mean, you know, we'll see.
I ended up with an old Schlitz beer sign that kind of rotates. And Victor actually held that for me and kind of gave that to me just to be nice. I liked Victor a lot. He was a good bartender, good guy.
Yeah, he was. He left, like, what, like a month early before the bar closed?
Yeah, I think he said he's going down to Cabo or something, and he's just going on vacation with his family, and I don't know. He was just, he was out of there a couple of weeks early.
Were you there at his going away?
I think I was, yeah. Oh, he was wasted.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
I remember now. He was completely hammered, and he was trying to kiss all kinds of girls and stuff.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember that now.
Yes, that's the one and only time that I saw him, like, super fucked up.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, it was amazing. It was amazing. He really deserved it. He was, like, dancing. I mean, I think, you know, had we egged him on, you know, enough, he would have started stripping in that bar. Like, it was great.
Yeah, he let loose that night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, you know, and the last night, like that Sunday going into the Monday, the bartenders that were there that night, they also got like really drunk. And it just got to a point where you just forgot you were even in a bar. It just felt like you were part of like a family party, you know. Everyone was just drinking and enjoying themselves and saying their goodbyes to everybody. I think I actually recorded like this video with my phone, and it's right at Monday, 2 a.m., so the supposed last call. And just, it was crazy. It was like a little riot in there, but it was good, you know? So I recorded that. I look at it from time to time.
Yeah. Yeah, those were the days. And now, you know, what does the future hold? You know, what is the new downtown going to be? I have hopes that there will be some more diversification downtown. I want there to be different kinds of people moving downtown. You know, I'm one of those people that when I wake up in the morning, some days I say, fuck downtown. Some days I say, I love downtown. Some days, you know, I'm cursing the hipsters. And then other days, you know, that restaurant over there that just opened up is pretty fucking good. And, you know, how can I be pissed at that? So I don't know. I'm very mixed about downtown, and I've been down here 12, 13 years now, and I've seen it change quite a bit, and I really don't know what the future holds.
How do you feel about all these pet owners moving into downtown?
Okay. I don't want to offend people who love their pets. I'm going to have to say that these little dogs are a fashion accessory. And I'm going to go ahead and say that it used to be homeless piss that I'd have to worry about on the streets, but now the streets are covered with dog piss, and it's everywhere.
Yeah, I agree. It's crazy.
You do agree? I was going out on a limb there. You're like, fuck you,
no,
I love my
dog. I am not a pet owner. I do not live in downtown, but it's just crazy to me that, you know, I have to, like, walk around looking at the ground, making sure I don't trip over any leashes or dogs or, like, dog shit. Honestly.
It's just too many, and it's just I don't get it. It feels very fashion accessory to me, and not, you know,
like legit.
Yeah, it doesn't seem legit. I don't know.
Yeah,
and people that have to take their dogs with them everywhere. I don't know. It's not my thing, but it, yeah. But downtown has made a fairly big industry off of that, and Bark Avenue and those guys, you know. God bless them for providing jobs, but, you know, they've kind of created this whole little dog economy down here.
Yeah, and there's, like, a park. I haven't been to it, but I hear there's, like, a dog park somewhere.
Well, they just opened up Spring Street Park.
Oh, that's where you can, like, have your dogs without a leash kind of place, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, that's very strange to me. Very strange.
It is strange when I think about downtown Los Angeles and... When did I first come down here? Probably in 2000, 2001, somewhere in that range. And, you know, after 6 p.m., it was a ghost town from Broadway East. And, well, really probably from Olive East, you know, there wasn't a soul. There was a few people up in the financial district and a couple things up there, like 7th and Fig was up there where people would still go eat, and some of the nicer hotels where people would be about. But past Olive, downtown was dead.
No, I didn't live in downtown, but I remember that. Because back in 2001-ish, I was in high school, and I do remember like going to a friend's house, like going to a party and in East LA, and I lived in Pico Union, so you kind of had to commute through downtown. And it was scary. Because you knew that you were not supposed to be in downtown past like 6 or 7.
Right.
You know, it was a little scary. It's very lonely, very desolate. There wasn't anything open, really. Everything was like all closed up with like the rail, the metal doors and all that.
I so I I remember coming down here. I had just moved from New York City to California again. I kind of went back and forth a few times, but that's a different story. But I was working in New York City and living in New Jersey, and then I came to Los Angeles, and I ended up like in Pasadena or something. First time I came to downtown Los Angeles, having been in New York City, I was like, what is going on? This isn't a downtown. It didn't feel like a downtown. And that's been the perception of downtown for a really long time. And unfortunately, even though it's changing and there's a lot of good things down here coming from the Renaissance, I think people's perception of downtown that live outside of downtown is still like, who goes downtown? Why would you want to go downtown? And in a way, that's unfortunate, because I want the diversity. I want to see old couples down here. I want to see families. I want to see what makes a New York City neighborhood end up downtown instead of just kind of all one kind of people. Because it seems like it's very like kind of, you know, 20s-something hipster, not really a care or a respect for downtown LA history. I want to see some different kinds of people come down here that make it a real neighborhood.
That sounds lovely. I've never been to New York, but the way you just painted it, that sounds lovely. Like, is that weird for you? I mean, because you've been here since before all of this happened and you're seeing it change. Is that weird for you?
It's weird when I lose the places that I really love. You know, I tend to romanticize these places in a lot of ways because of Bukowski. And you know, if you read something, it's beautiful no matter what, because you create this image in your mind. And so when I lose places like Krabby Joe's, when, you know, I used to go into Kohl's before it was bought out by the 213 group and said Moses. And I remember this guy, this old German guy named Marty, who they always had Spaten on tap. And I'd go in there and just hang out in that bar, you know, before it switched over. And then, you know, said Moses bought it. He did an absolutely beautiful restoration to it, and the drink prices doubled. And it's an expensive place to go now, where that's not what it was before. So those types of things make me sad. You know, King Eddie's, you know, definitely makes me sad. You know, I'm trying the best I can to just kind of go with it. And I can still go in there and get drunk. And depending on what bartender's in there, I can feel like, you know, it's my bar again. But it's tough.
Yeah, it is tough. But you went to Camper's Corner recently. I haven't gone there.
Yeah, I went there yesterday. Me and my roommate, he's whiter than I am. He's like from North Dakota.
Oh God.
So these two weddos come walking in a bar, and it was funny. I told my one friend, Eddie Solis, who does a show here called Los Angeles Nista Mondays from 9 p.m. to 11, plug. I told him I went to Camper's Corner. He's like, hey, man, that's where the fucking cartels hang out. And I'm like, what do you mean, man? And I just think that's kind of funny. It could be true. I have no idea. But I go in there. All the women are almost like mandatorily dressed in short skirts. And you know, they don't look like they really want to be in short skirts, but they are. And, you know, it's guys in cowboy hats and boots, and they're playing Vicente Fernandez on the jukebox, and I'm just drinking my Victoria, you know.
That's totally not how I had imagined it. Like, I thought you're gonna walk in, everybody's just gonna stop, like the jukebox is gonna stop playing, and everybody's just gonna stare at you like, oh, this guy totally doesn't belong here.
I you know, it's funny, because the first few times I went in there, it was definitely like that. Like, I think one guy like bought me a drink just because he said that I had enough balls to even walk in the door, and that was enough to buy me a drink. But I think they've seen me a few times now that I think they're confused still. Like, why do I even bother going in there? But they just don't care anymore. So the first time I felt a tranny's tits was at that bar.
How were they? Did they feel so supple?
They felt like kind of hard. Like it wasn't a
stone. Like how hard?
Just, it was probably a bad surgery.
Are you sure it was her tits that you were touching?
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. I mean, did they look better than how they felt?
I didn't see them. Oh. It was just over the tube top.
Oh. Well, you should have asked to see them. Sometimes they look better.
Yeah, I guess I should have.
That's crazy. That's definitely one bar that, you know, I was, when the Kiani, towards the end when it was closing, I was like, you know, I'm going to go to that bar and I'm going to see what that's about. Because I did not give Kiani the benefit of the doubt before I went there. And then a lot of the patrons were like, you do not want to go there. Like, that's not the place to be. They were just so scared of it. And I was like, well, and you know, it's funny because towards the end when it was like, you know, known fact that the Kiani was closing, I was like, okay, I'm going to organize this bar. We're going to all meet up at some other bar and it's going to be the same thing. We're just all going to be together. So I was like, okay, we're going to meet up at Camper's Corner. And the looks that I got was just like, no, nobody goes there. Like, no, you do not want to be there. That's not the place to be. They were so scared of it. So naturally.
Yeah, Camper's Corner is a, it's a beer wine bar.
Oh, so it's not even a full bar.
No, it's not a full bar.
Oh, that's terrible.
They'll serve you peanuts in a styrofoam cup.
Oh, that's terrible.
And they tend to be closed. Like, they don't really stay open past 10 p.m.
No, that kind of makes sense. That area is
a weird spot.
Yeah, it's kind of shady right there.
Yeah.
You know which bar I kind of really liked at one point or another, and then I kind of felt really bad for it. Have you ever been to like Mel's Bar or Mal's Bar?
Yeah, Mal's over on Hill Street.
Yeah, you know, I really liked that bar at one point, and then it went into these renovations. And the last time I was there, it was like a Saturday night. I got there like at 10:30, and I'm sad to say that I was like one of maybe like five people total in that bar.
Really?
Yeah, and like you gotta, you know, it was me and my friend and like the three bartenders, you know.
I was at Mal's Bar a while ago. We actually did a live remote there for one of our older shows. And yeah, it was one of those places where I went in and I'm like, this could be a really cool bar. But there wasn't a whole lot of people there and I didn't really know what it was about. Like the location is a little strange. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know what it is. But yeah.
Yeah, I think I went there once. The one and only time that I went there, that there was like a ton of people, it was because the Sweet and Tender Hooligans, that's like a cover band for like the Smiths and Morrissey, were doing an acoustic show with like some other band called The Cured. Obviously, you know, a cover band for The
Tribute
Cure.
Band.
Yeah, so they were doing like an acoustic set, and so there was like all these rockabilly kids there, and it was great. It was like a good time. But aside from that, it's just it's deserted. There's no one there. And the space is great. I mean, it has so much potential.
They got a little stage. And
yeah.
They used to. You said it got renovated, so maybe I haven't seen its latest incarnation.
No. The stage is still there. It's a little bit nicer. They still have the popcorn machine. It's the same thing. They tried to do, like, this outdoor kind of courtyard area, but really all that means is that they bought, like, these bamboo walls, you know, and they kind of just put him, they set him up on the sidewalk. So it's not really like an outdoor area. It's just a sidewalk.
Hmm.
You know?
Any other bars that are kind of like that? You know, a little less known bars? Do you know about the back door at the Milner Hotel?
No, you were telling me about that. Where's that?
So the Milner Hotel, do you, if you know IHOP, which I think what is that Flower? That's like 8th and Flower?
Yeah.
Somewhere in that area. Across the street, there's the Milner Hotel, and there used to be a bar there that was in the back called the Back Door, and it was just a bare bones, tiny little bar, and, you know, people who, you know, happened to be staying in that hotel would go down there and have a drink, so you'd get a real mixed crowd. I like the crowd there because it's hotel people, so they're from all over. And sometimes they have no idea how they ended up in downtown L.A., but they're there. And I tried to go there a few months ago, maybe 3-4 months ago, and they said it was closed for renovations. So I have no idea what that means or when it's going to be reopened, but that's a bar to check out that not a lot of people knew about.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Well, I hope it comes back, and I hope it's not that much different than what you're describing.
Yeah, I got a thing for hotel bars, actually. And I think what it is that people that end up at hotel bars are from all over the place, you know, and sometimes it's interesting. You can sit there and have a conversation with these people from, I'm from Wisconsin and I'm here on business and I don't know what the hell's going on. So my first instinct is to go to the bar and have a drink and, you know, kind of a universal language, you know, I'm in a strange place. Let me go to the bar. That's where I'll figure it out.
Well, that's where you figure out a lot of things about life, about yourself. It starts with that drink. It's true. It's true. Well, I'm really sad to say my friends and I were, you know, kind of sort of regulars at Weiland's, the one that was like on first.
Oh, yeah. And they closed recently, right?
Yeah. You know, it's so sad because we have been going there for happy hour, I want to say maybe like the last 3-4 years. And you know, over the last couple years, it's changed a little bit. The menu changed, the prices changed, but you know, we still continue to go there because that's kind of like where we all, you know, bonded and became friends. And we didn't even know that it was closing. We knew about a year ago that I guess the MTA bought that whole space. So where Weiland's is at, Senior Fish and the Spice Table. And so those businesses were going to be forced to close at the end of this year. So we knew that. But I guess the owner of Weiland's found a new space in Long Beach, and so he just decided to close early. And so it was really sad because we were giving Senior Fish a try the weekend that it was closing, and we saw that Weiland's was super packed, but we were like, well, I wonder if it's like a private party, or we didn't really know what was going on. And then come Monday, we find out that that was the last weekend, so we didn't even get to see it off, and it's closed.
You know what's funny is I remember going to Weiland's over in the financial district. They had two locations.
Yeah, they do. They have one that's like across the street from the library. But that one, I think there's less people because it's parking is a little bit harder and there's not like a whole ton of people that know that it even exists right there.
Yeah.
I haven't been to that one. But the one that we used to go to is the one on First and Central, and now it's gone. And so I guess the owner was saying that, you know, he found this space in Long Beach and they're going to open up there. And he's not even sure if they're going to call it Weiland's. He might call it something else. So.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's gone. It's kind of sad.
Yeah. Well, Hazel, this has been a great discussion, bringing back a lot of memories. You definitely know what you're talking about with downtown bars, and that's great. Thanks for coming in.
No, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, maybe we can do this more often. And, you know, it doesn't have to be all bars all the time, but there's lots of things to talk about.
Who are we kidding? I'm a lush and you're drunk. Let's just be honest.
Okay,
we are
right.
What we are.
You're right. Cool. Well, thank you, Hazel.
Well, thank you.